What is your big project that you were so busy earlier today that you couldn't text me back?
Oh, it's not
'Cause
work, I'll
rude.
tell you that. It's fun employment, as we're calling it. I'm building a tree house outside.
Like
Just
in a
because,
tree?
no, on the ground. Yes,
Well,
in
like
a tree.
you're gonna climb up a tree.
With a ladder, and so are the kids,
Oh
but it's going to be
my
like
God.
an adult fort slash kid fun zone.
You are gonna fall out and break a hip.
Most likely. There's no railing on right now, so every time I get close to the end, it's scarier than it would have been 20 years ago. Like, I think I understand how brittle I really am, understand the consequences. If I go falling off the side of that ledge, I will die.
Oh my God. Everybody, we gotta start a GoFundMe for your medical bills.
That's true. Well, in a couple of weeks, we can talk about it in the treehouse.
Yes. Oh my God. Can we do our first like recording together in the treehouse?
Tales from the treehouse.
Shut the hell up. I'm so in.
Tuesday, and you're listening to Murder Unscripted.
What is up, crime crew? Welcome to episode 51 of Murder Unscripted, the most immersive true crime podcast on the internet today. I'm your host, Ed Hydock, along with the peanut butter to my jelly, Melissa Spivey.
Oh my God, that was the nicest thing you've ever said.
It's mainly because you're gloopy and a weird tan color.
And kind of chunky, I get it.
Love you. If this is your first time joining us, I am a true crime producer of 23 years and counting, and Melissa is a true crime fanatic, probably for almost as long as I've been a producer. So we tell hour-long stories, which are presented in monthly blocks or themes. And for this month, we're knee-deep in a block called Podcasters Killed the Radio Star. And in this block, we're diving into crimes against TV and radio personalities as we lead up to our guests this month. And if you caught that, I did say guests. And if you've been following along, you'll know we're running a little contest. And if you can guess the guests on our social media, based on the clues that we're giving, you can send us an email, DM us, however you want to do it. We'll send you a pretty sweet sticker pack with our new batch of stickers. And Melissa, do you want to remind our listeners of the clue you gave last week and possibly provide another clue?
Absolutely, I do. So last week, I told you that these guests are not the worst, but they are the best. And if you didn't get it with that one, here's another hint. Our guests are double the fun.
That's a pretty good clue.
I'm so excited.
I'm curious if anyone's going to guess. I think somebody
I know,
will.
me too.
So again, if you think you know the answer, be sure to comment, shoot us a message with the right answer, and we will get you some stickers. And that actual guest announcement will happen in the ne on next week's show. So stay tuned for that. And speaking of which, if you like what you're hearing, please be sure to rate, like, subscribe to Murder Unscripted. It really goes a long way to helping us continue to do what we do.
Yes, please do that. It's super helpful, and we would forever appreciate you.
It's true. So, with that housekeeping out of the way, I have a super obscure tale to tell you today. And this is a case that I had found for the original Forensic Files in probably my second or third year there. So, we're going way back to 2005. And this is a case that would eventually be called Garden of Evil. And I know it was season 10 of Forensic Files, and I want to say episode 31 based on the notes that I have.
How did Forensic Files name their episodes? Like, was there a system or was there like one person who picked all of the names? Did you get to name your own?
Yeah, that was actually one of the coolest parts of writing pitches for Forensic Files because we would kind of name our own episodes within reason, of course. They couldn't be too tongue in cheek. Like, you wanted to make them catchy and also relevant and like a really good play on words, but when we would
Yeah.
submit a pitch, we would basically add 4 to 5 title suggestions kind of at the end. And eventually the executive producer would pick the final one. And that's how I got so good with these plays on words. Like, I've made a living out of creating puns and I don't know. My titles usually got picked more often than not.
I feel like your puns are so like dad joke, but they also were.
Like Garden of Evil, you'll see why that's the perfect title for this, but it's also like, it's in the biblical sense. So enough of the chatter. So let's get into today's case, which focuses on the 1987 murder of beloved radio DJ Debbie Dykus.
When you first said like you were going to cover this case, I could not stop calling her Diane Dykus. I think I'm getting her confused with Diane Newton King, who was also a Forensic Files episode, and she was a news anchor who was killed in her driveway. Actually, I think I might cover her for one of our MU minis.
You should. That's a good case. I always see discus, like the thing you throw in track and field. When I see her name, like Dykus, I always put a C in there, discus.
Oh, yeah, I could see that. Yeah.
Totally. Well, she was, in fact, named Debbie Dykus, and her murder shocked the Virginia community where she lived, as well as the world of radio. So in order to tell Debbie's story and set the stage, Melissa, would you mind firing up the old time machine and taking us back to Hampton, Virginia in 1987?
Oh, I would so very much love to. And I will provide the sound effects because mine are way better than the
Please do.
One you picked. Beep, boop, beep, boop. And just like that, we're back in 1987.
Wow.
And I swear we already covered a case in 87, like prior to this episode, but I cannot for the life of me remember which one. I was going through all of our episodes earlier and I could not figure it out. But I didn't want to just tell you, like, you know, the best food and, like, the hot toy that year if I already did that.
Okay.
So I decided to, like, look up what was happening in 1987 in the world of true crime. And, oh, my God, 87 did not disappoint.
Hmm.
Also, that's the year I was born, so it really did not disappoint.
Oh, but, well, not disappoint everyone. Some of us.
A couple people. Yeah, fair. All right, well, this is huge. So it was actually in 1987 that DNA evidence was first used in a U.S. criminal court.
That's a fact. I actually knew that.
Did you?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know it was 87. Well, I want to tell you quickly about the case. So beginning in 1986, there was a serial rapist who was like terrorizing Orlando, Florida. And he had already attacked and sexually assaulted about 24 women. So then, isn't that wild? So in February of 1987, the serial rapist monster, his name was Tommy Lee Andrews, he broke into the home of a woman named Karen Monroe, and Karen lived in this home with her two young daughters. And we find out later that actually he broke in through the window in the daughter's room, which is terrifying.
Yeah, I'll say.
But once he's in the house, Tommy Lee Andrews makes his way to Karen's room and he holds a knife to her throat as he proceeded to like viciously rape her. And the whole time he's like trying to choke and smother her. So then he steals Karen's purse and he flees the residence. Luckily, he obviously wasn't very bright because he kind of returned to the scene of the crime, like somewhere in the neighborhood. And he was being like a perv ball and peeking into people's windows. So somebody noticed him and called police. And this ultimately led to Andrews like leading the cops on a car chase, which only ended because his dumbass crashed the car. Like rule number one of a car chase, don't crash.
They always do.
Well, when the case went to trial, the prosecutor presented a few different types of evidence. And one of the types was DNA. And they were able to compare the semen that he left in the victim to blood that they took from him. And thanks to that DNA, this monster was convicted of rape, burglary, and aggravated burglary. So that's where we went in our time machine today. We skipped the hottest toy and fad.
Well, that's okay. No, that's very important because this be interesting to see if DNA was being used at the time in Hampton, Virginia, how it would have applied to this case. So as we get into it, you'll kind of see some spots where it might have helped out.
Hmm. All right. Well, I'm excited. I don't know this case. I like purposely didn't watch or look it up or anything. So
this is obscure. Yeah, this is a really kind of obscure one. And it's one that I can guarantee you won't see on any of the newer crime shows because they're an hour long. So unless something comes out, like this barely filled 22 minutes when you take commercials out. And so it makes sense why you haven't seen it all over some of the bigger ones. That was the luxury of Forensic Files, though. 30 minutes. So we'll start off this case by telling you a little bit about our victim today. And her name is Debbie Josephine Dykus. And she was born on October 23rd, 1955 to parents Mark and Jean. She grew up with two sisters in rural Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Her older sister's name is also Jean or Jeannie. It's spelled differently. It's like Jean with two E's on the end. So it could be Jean or it's with two N's. Sorry. So it could be Jeannie.
Yeah.
And I was not able to find her other sister's name. And not much is really known about Debbie's childhood, but what we do know was that she was, quote, an earthy country girl through and through. And that's mainly because where she grew up in North Carolina was super rural. And that's something that Debbie kept with her as she got older. Colleagues would often say, quote, she was great, pretty laid back, real natural type of gal. You know, not really a slave to fashion and stuff like that. She wore jeans and a t-shirt and looked good in them too.
Aw, I love that she like never lost her country girl roots.
She did not. Yeah, she kept that with her even when she rose to kind of local celebrity status, which we'll talk about in a second. And that was definitely Debbie, like a country girl. And one of the things that we do know about her that she loved to garden. She loved working with her hands. And tending to her garden was literally Debbie's favorite hobby, especially tomatoes.
Aww.
So after graduating with a degree in broadcasting, and I assume that I could not find, but when you go on to become a radio DJ, I assume your degree is in broadcasting. So that was an educated guess. But I do know that it was in or around 1977 because her backstory is so fuzzy. And at the time, she was 20-year-old Debbie would land at WTAR-AM, which was a Norfolk, Virginia talk radio station. Dick Lamb, who was the managing editor at the station where Debbie ended up working at the time she was killed, also worked with Debbie at WTAR. And back in 87, he told the Newport News Daily Press, quote, when we'd come to the station, she'd have out vegetables with a note attached saying, help yourself, they're from Debbie's garden, end quote.
Aw, that's so sweet. She sounds like one of those people. I had a neighbor like this who they just like grow way more than they could possibly eat in a lifetime. But like, it's just because they love gardening.
It wasn't about the harvest. It was about the process of just seeing something flourish, something that she planted with her own two hands. Aww. So not long after she started at WTAR, Debbie met a man who would become her boyfriend, Bill Campbell. And around 1980, Debbie and Bill found themselves a place at the Mill Point apartment complex in downtown Hampton, Virginia. Melissa, are there certain things that you look for when you're scouting for an apartment?
I mean, obviously rent, like the cost, the rent price is important. The space, storage, safety, like neighborhood crime rate. You know, I looked that up first, but
I'm sure. Yeah.
I guess also like proximity to things like, is there a Michaels? Is there a Target?
Is there
Can
a
I
Pet
get
Smart?
There quickly? Is there a Dunkin'? Can I get my coffee?
I completely agree that all of those things are important. But one of the reasons that Debbie chose Mill Point is because it was close to a city-owned garden plot. So let me tell you about these plots so you can start to picture them in your mind because it's going to be important in the story later on. So as a starting point, we can now use the defunct Coliseum Mall, which was located kind of downtown Hampton, Virginia. And you basically from there, you follow Mercury Road, which was at the time a pretty busy road, and it may still be today, to a road called Marcella Road. And this was kind of a long winding road that went out the back of the Coliseum Mall parking lot. And if you follow that about a mile, you bump into this 50-acre tract of land. And the land has been run by the Hampton Parks Department since the late 1970s. And basically a third of that land, so I figured it out like 17, 18 acres, were basically subdivided then into these 20 by 40 garden plots. And on each corner of the plots, they had these big 55-gallon black barrels with, there was a letter, like a letter of the alphabet spray painted on them. And it basically kind of helped, made a big grid so you could keep organized. The city would basically lease these plots to citizens and residents who didn't have room for a garden. So most of the folks there had one plot, sometimes two, but you could have as many as you want, depending on how much you wanted to grow and how much you felt like spending on a garden plot. So needless to say, Debbie obviously owned one of these plots and spent almost all of her free time there.
That's a really cool idea. It's like a little slice of the country, but like in the middle of a city.
Absolutely. And Hampton is not a metropolis, maybe like you're picturing, but it's for people that don't have a lot of, don't have a yard, don't have a space mm-hmm. on their balcony, or maybe they have room on their balcony for a potted plant, but they want to grow more. I do want to bring up, though, that these gardens are not in the safest area. So Bill Campbell actually would often discourage Debbie from going there in the late afternoon hours because it was just not in a nice part of town. And it was because it was this 50 acres, it was kind of rural and out there away from civilization a little bit.
I was going to say, I imagine that it's probably not well lit either. And right. like you just said, probably kind of rural, that if you were there, there may not be anyone else there at that time.
It may not be lit at all. I mean, this is out there, you know, and it might be like a yeah. park where it just closes at sunset.
Right.
Well, fast forward to 1984, and now 28-year-old Debbie is in the prime of her life. She and Bill are living the dream in Hampton, Virginia. She's loving her garden plot, and this is when Debbie starts the next chapter of her career, when she becomes the nighttime DJ at WWDE-FM. And WWDE is often referred to as 2WD, and it still is. And it's a station that plays mostly adult contemporary music, so probably right up your alley. Definitely not mine, but...
Wait, I have a question. What kind of DJ was she? Like, I'm picturing, do you remember Delilah?
I do, yeah.
That's Delilah. Kind of what I'm picturing. Yes. Yeah.
She like was... Did Delilah play music, too?
She did, yeah. It was like you called in and you were like, oh, so-and-so is so wonderful and I want to dedicate a song, da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah,
and then
so
he would play the song.
I think that's on par with kind of where the show that Debbie was running to.
Got it.
And interestingly, Debbie's boyfriend, Bill, was the program director there. And it's a little unclear, but I suspect that he had been there for years and actually helped get Debbie the job. That's just my hunch based on what I know about it. But either way, so that's cool.
Good for her.
Yeah, totally. So over the next 3 years, Debbie was in charge of most of 2WD's community events, but she also became a beloved voice on the local airwaves. Her bosses would say Debbie had, quote, a great voice and a keen sense for the music we played, end quote. She would often tell the audience, this was what made her Delilah-like, I think, because mm-hmm. she would say, I'm feeling this kind of way today, or I'm feeling that kind of way today. Or she'd like, if she was happy or sad or upset about something that happened in her life, was really an open book. And she'd basically say, why don't you call in and tell me what's going on with your life? So she developed this kind of rapport with her listeners. And from what I understand, it was a very loyal fan base. So here's actually a clip of Debbie on the air.
Debbie Dykus, 2WD.
Why don't you and I make sure Maryland and lots of kids like her are not disappointed again this year?
I can see why, like, people liked her a lot and wanted to listen to her. She had a really friendly voice, if that makes sense. Like, I think the best kind of podcast host or radio DJ or whatever makes it feel like you're sitting in a room with friends. And like, mm-hmm. that's kind of how I felt when we were just listening to that.
Could not agree more with that assessment. And now that we have an idea of who Debbie was, let's talk about the absolutely horrendous things that happened to her. So we're going to jump ahead 3 years to Saturday, May 9th, 1987. It was a day like any other day. And the now 31-year-old Debbie hadn't worked that day, so she and Bill actually spent the day bopping around, taking care of some errands and kind of odds and ends. And I had read that she actually quit about 3 weeks before this happened. And it doesn't play a role in the story in any way, shape, or form, so I didn't even bring it up. But I'm not sure why she left. I don't know if she had another job, but she had some free time from what I understand.
Oh, wow. She quit the radio station? Like, yeah, she quit her show?
Like a couple weeks before this happened. So she might have been moving on to something else. I don't know.
Yeah.
But the couple did have plans later that night to go to dinner and a movie with some friends of theirs. But that wasn't until later. So Debbie knew she had a couple hours to go tend to her garden in the afternoon. So around 4 o'clock p.m., she kisses Bill goodbye and gets into her car, loaded up with some garden tools. She had a rake, a hoe, some buckets, and a couple jugs filled with water for her plants, because you had to bring your own stuff when you went out there.
Yeah.
But by 7 p.m., Debbie still hadn't returned, and Bill was obviously worried sick at this point, because remember, they had dinner plans with their friends later on that night. So, cue the crow.
Dun, dun, dun!
Right? So, Bill immediately hopped in his car, and he headed down to the community garden plot, because he knew where she was going, so that was obviously the place he wanted to look. And as he approached the entrance, he saw the lights and sirens and crime scene tape stretched across the entrance. And we had interviewed Bill for the Forensic Files episode, and he said he just knew that whatever was going on in that garden was about Debbie and that something bad happened.
I can't imagine the feeling, but like I can imagine pulling up and just like already knowing that she's not home, which is weird when they know they have things to do. And then you get there and I'm sure his stomach just dropped. And I also feel like we've talked about this in other episodes where like there have been parents who are like, I knew that she was gone, like about their child. So I almost feel like that's kind of how he felt, like he knew just instinctively that something was very wrong.
Absolutely. And that's true. Just from talking to him, that's exactly how he felt. So what happened? How did we get here? Just a few moments earlier, a 20-year-old local man named Ronald Blanchard had called 911, and he was a waterman. Melissa, do you know what a waterman is?
A waterman? Like a water boy?
No, but a waterman is like a fisherman, just someone that works around the water. So they go on fishing boats, they pull up.
I've never heard that.
Yeah, crazy. They'll dredge the floor for scallops and the bay floor for scallops too. So depending on what kind of scallops you want, clams, oysters, and unload fish when they come in from the dock.
Why don't they just call him a fisherman?
Because he's not catch. I don't know. He's like a deckhand. He's helping. Okay. I don't know if he's actually.
Oh, okay.
Stop analyzing the guy's job. It's not about his job. He's a waterman. Just know that he's a waterman.
It's just a weird word, waterman.
All right, fine. He's a fisherman, a local fisherman, right? It doesn't matter.
Thank you.
So Ronald Blanchard and his wife, Debbie, not to be confused with Debbie Dykus. So I will try to call her Debbie Blanchard, or at least differentiate between the two. They lived on the grounds of the Beacon Baptist Church, which was located about a quarter mile away from the city garden plots. So basically it was walking distance. And the couple lived there in an upstairs apartment with Debbie's mom, as well as their 6-month-old son. And Ronald and Debbie had plans to go bowling that evening, but because it was a nice night, Ronald decided to take a stroll beforehand before they went out. And this wasn't strange at all because Ronald did this every night for exercise. So now we've got Ronald on a walk and Debbie Blanchard all, I don't know, call it gussied up to go bowling.
Gussied at home up? For How old are you?
She's dressed for bowling. Waiting
She's
for
getting
Ronald.
Ready. We don't gussy up. Pop Ed.
She was gussying up for bowling, as one does.
As one does.
Waiting for her husband to come back from his walk. So shortly after 7, Ronald does come through the front door, but he's completely out of breath and covered in blood. And he tells Debbie, quote, Debbie, I found a dead body back there in the garden, end quote. Ronald says he rolled the victim over and checked for a pulse, but they could not find one. So at that point, the couple obviously cancels their bowling plans and calls 911, which I assume was 0 back in those days, and they had to ask for an operator. So police respond within minutes, and now we're at the spot in the story where the crime scene tape is stretched across the entrance to the garden, and Bill Campbell is there worried sick about Debbie Dykus, and Bill is there trying to push his way through the officers that are like guarding the tape and not letting him in just to try to see what happened. And they'd say, we can't let you through. So he describes Debbie, says, my girlfriend's in there. He describes Debbie, what she looks like, what she was wearing. And unfortunately, the officer breaks the news that it's likely her and she was likely murdered.
Oh, poor Bill. Like, just such a normal day. And they had plans that night. And she probably did this, like went to the garden same time of day, like all the time. And
incredibly heartbreaking.
Yeah.
So investigators begin their sweep of the crime scene. And as I mentioned earlier, this is roughly a 17-18 acre plot of land that's broken up into these individual plots. But Debbie wasn't found in her plot. So she was actually found in this muddy ditch just a few feet from her car, which was up on a little embankment. So it created this swale that collected water and dirt and debris. It was a ditch, basically. And one of the first investigators on the scene is J.D. Spencer of the Hampton Police. And we had interviewed J.D. and another retired detective, Glenel Fullman, for the Forensic Files episode. And both had amazingly good recollections for, this was going back to 05. So, I mean, that was 18 years at that point. But that was still, they had a really good recall about what happened. Every little detail.
I think that some cases, certain cases, just stick with investigators. And I think that they can probably almost transport themselves like right back to that day if they think about it.
It's true. And when we do the more obscure cases, like these detectives work so many crimes that not all of them do stick out. But when you approach them about it, they'll remember like broad strokes and then they'll go review the file. So then come interview time, they're like ready to rock and roll. Cause it's like they prepare to testify. They would do the exact same thing.
Right.
So J.D. Spencer approaches this victim and he can tell she's a young white woman somewhere between the age of 25 and 30. She had this blonde hair and was laying partially on her side. She was wearing her bra and underwear, but her blue shirt had been removed and was found near the body, and her jeans were pulled down to her ankles. And based on the description that Bill Campbell had just provided to the officers on scene, it was pretty clear that the victim was Debbie Dykus. So I do also want to mention that it was clear Debbie put up a hell of a fight. Her hair barrettes were on the ground, her cigarettes had fallen out of her pocket, and there was blood on the back of her car. So she likely did not go down easy. So, Melissa, given what I just told you, what are your kind of initial impressions of this crime scene and or the person who did it?
Well, I feel like immediately when you see a body laying like that, like especially a woman without clothes on or her pants down at her ankles, you have to assume it was some sort of sexual assault or would be sexual assault, and that led to the murder. But I do think it's weird that it's kind of out in the middle of nowhere. So this to me is almost more like a random or opportunistic kind of crime.
We shall see. I know the answer.
I would hope you do.
Well, based on what detectives were seeing, it definitely appeared that this was a sex crime gone wrong. Just by the way she was laid out and the position of her clothing being off. It's almost like they interrupted a rape and something went out of hand. But yeah. So let's talk about Debbie's injuries, which were caused mostly by blunt force. So she had these massive bruises all over her face and her neck and the back of her neck. And also they call it the trunk, your torso, basically. Mm-hmm. She also had these gigantic, probably 3-4 inch cuts, deep cuts on the top of her head. Basically, her scalp was hanging open in several spots. Oh. So this was a pretty brutal attack, and police don't have to look far to find the alleged murder weapon. And this part is sad, but it also gives you some insight, like you just talked about the nature of the attack. On the ground is Debbie's own hoe that she brought to till the garden with. And it's basically snapped in half. Like it's not two separate pieces, but you can see this big split in the middle where it's cracked. And there's skin and blood and mud on the blade end, which would eventually come back to match Debbie's hair.
So I feel like that is opportunistic, because if the person killed her, they obviously didn't come with their own weapon if they used what she had brought, right?
That's what it appeared to detectives. I mean, you're looking at these sharp, you know, sharp slices in her head, and you see an object that's about the same length and is sharp. And I mean, just put two and two together, plus there's hair and material in it. So.
Right. But I mean, I think it stands out that like it was something that she had brought with her, not something that whoever did this had with them.
Correct. And I was just getting at the fact that even if the killer brought something and used it, he also used the hoe, because that was clearly, so he may have brought a gun or a knife, but then, so it's still too early in the investigation to tell. But yeah, that's a good assumption. So let's get into some suspects. And there's an obvious one staring police right in the face. And that is Ronald Blanchard, the 20-year-old fisherman who found the body. Ronald and his entire family had accompanied police to the crime scene in order to kind of direct them to the body. Remember, he called police initially. So he was still there with his family while this small crowd was gathering as well around the crime scene tape. And you're going to love this next part. So remember when I mentioned another detective named Glenel Fullman? So she had a sniffer dog named Rhodey. And Rhodey had worked over 700 crime scenes in his career with Fullman, and he had a 99% success rate. According to Fullman, that meant he almost always found what he was looking for.
Aww, this is why dogs are the best, and so much better than humans, because I guarantee there is no cop out there who has a 99% accuracy. So this dog should be like Policeman of the Year.
And so Fullman goes through her routine with Rhodey. So basically, she walks him over to where the broken hoe is found on the ground. And I wasn't talking about you. I'm talking about the presumed murder weapon.
Ah, I knew that was coming.
So she sits Rhodey down, sits down next to him and like makes small talk. She's just kind of petting him and soothing him and talk, just establishing that bond. And then she gives him the command sook. And so Rhodey begins sooking. And he makes his way. He's like looking to see where this trail goes from the hoe to wherever. And what does he do? He walks over to where all the people are gathered and immediately goes up to Ronald Blanchard, the guy who called 911, we're going to just say. And he begins like sniffing the backs of his legs, at which point Fulman pulled Rhodey back. He did his job.
But wouldn't that just mean, I mean, we already know that Ronald had been near her, if what he's saying is true about turning her over and checking her pulse, because so wouldn't it just be like, that's what Rhodey smelled?
Absolutely it could. And police knew that. So it's interesting, though, that Rhodey sniffed the hoe and not the body, because you know what I mean? The ultimate goal was connecting someone to that murder weapon. So it's not good news for Blanchard.
Oh, yeah. Why would he should have had no contact with the hoe. He had contact with her body, not
exactly.
Okay. I'm picking up what you're putting down.
That's where Rhodey comes into play. It does get worse, though, because Blanchard's truck is also parked at the scene, and police look over and they notice this like gun rack on the back. Have you ever seen those on the backs of trucks? They might be called back racks, where you see them down south a lot on big trucks. It's basically they got their rifles, four or five rifles strapped to the back.
I'm going to keep my comments to myself.
That's fine. So, yeah. But as it turns out, they walk over there and they ask him about it. And hanging in there is this like air rifle. An air rifle is basically like these airsoft guns. So it doesn't use combustion to blast out a bullet. It just uses CO2. So picture a high powered BB gun. You can pump them. Sometimes they're shotgun like. So Ronald quickly admits to police that he uses that gun to hunt birds all the time. And usually on his walk, sometimes he'll shoot tin cans on a fence. Like it's very rural behavior. Cool. Yeah.
Yes, it is.
But he readily turns over this weapon, and which, what else are you going to do at that point? And police look at it and they're like, they can see the stock is all jacked up. And it's basically the big plastic part on the back, kind of where it's not the butt that sits on your shoulder, but it's the plate in front of the butt that just kind of sits right here is the stock. So that thing is all bent and it's mangled and muddy. And get this, we were talking about evidence on the ground near Debbie's car. Mm-hmm. Well, they find a broken piece of plastic that looks exactly like the damage found on the stock of Ronald's gun. So they gather up the rifle and the broken piece of plastic and they ship it off to the crime lab, along with the clothes he was wearing. Like Ronald willingly turned over his clothes too. And following that, they bring him down to the station for questioning then. And in this interrogation, Ronald could not be more cooperative. His story never changes once. He tells police that he and Debbie, his wife Debbie Blanchard, spent the morning painting the roof of a cabin on a clam boat, being a waterman and all. That he,
mm-hmm. waterman.
Yeah, and his boat was docked in the James River, and he details then going for a walk a few hours before he and Debbie were supposed to go bowling. And he even brought up that, like, we like to go early because you get a better lane. So it was important to go on this walk and go home and go bowling. And while he was walking past the garden, he saw what looked to be a person's shoulder in the ditch. So he approached it and then immediately noticed it was a body. And he admits he rolled her over, checked for a pulse, which was why he was all bloody. It was all over his hands and on his shirt. Not too bad on his shirt, mostly on his hands. And he says he never, ever touched the hoe. And I believe I told you that Ronald was also muddy when he came back home to call police. And remember, Debbie was found down this little embankment. Well, Ronald said he slipped when his way down to find the body because it had just rained. So Debbie was actually found in a little tiny body of water, but he had slipped and that's why he was covered away. So that explains the mud.
Yeah, but I still don't like the fact that he specifically tells them he didn't touch the hoe, but Rhodey says he did.
Rhodey does say he did. And
I'm always going to take the dog side.
As you should. So despite all of the evidence that initially seems to point to Ronald, police really don't have much because all of that evidence they have is kind of dependent on what the crime lab has to say. So Ronald is obviously free to go as police explore other suspects. And one person they need to account for is Debbie Dykus's boyfriend, Bill Campbell.
Well, yeah. I mean, we always talk about like the police starting with a significant other. That's always the first person they go to. And he obviously knew Debbie was going to be at the garden that night. And he probably was familiar with it enough to know, like, it's usually not that busy when she goes at this time. Maybe he followed her.
It's true. And it's something that police needed to rule out, especially because remember, Bill Campbell had showed up at the crime scene before police were even, remember, they were already there and he just shows up like, what's going on here?
Right.
Well, police questioned Bill, and I want to put this kind of to bed immediately. I'm not going to play the whodunit game right now because he didn't have anything to do with it. This guy cared about Debbie so much. He was just a really upstanding dude who was simply worried about his girlfriend. And they had a fantastic relationship, and Bill was absolutely devastated by Debbie's death. So let's just rule that out right now.
Poor Bill.
Yeah, he's a good dude. When he interviewed, he was just really real about his feelings. Yeah. And he broke down a couple times, but I mean, he was just real is the best way to put it. So the next suspect that crosses detective's desk is a young man named Michael LaPrade. And this was a tip that was called in when in those very early stages when police were looking for any information from the community. Because Michael was a well-known youngster in the area who would hang out in the cemetery adjacent to the gardens. And it takes the police a little bit of time, but they're able to track Michael down and determine that he was actually out of town at the time of the murder. And I only bring Michael up, and also Bill Campbell, to be completely honest, because this isn't what we always talk about regarding red herrings in these TV shows. Police didn't suspect for a second that either one of these guys had anything to do with this crime, but because their names appeared in the case file and they were people that it was more of like crossing your T's and dotting your I's rather than a full on investigation. They were just making sure these guys were, you know, out of the picture. But the creative team is tasked with how do we turn this story into like a mystery on television? So like we're plucking these little names out, trying to like stretch it out. And I think the whole section about Michael LaPrade in the Forensic Files episode is like 45 seconds. So even we couldn't make much of this. We couldn't make a meal out of this morsel, but it did eat up a minute of television time. So that's the goal.
Yeah, I've noticed, especially with Forensic Files episodes, where like they talk about a suspect. And then when I actually go to look the case up, like some of the sources don't even mention the person.
Keep in mind, though, that especially on Forensic Files, we would more often than not give aliases. So you may be looking for an alias name that is purposely different. So you may not be able to find anything unless you knew the person's real name in the case file.
That's true.
So that being said, when you take away boyfriend Bill and this weak ass suspect, Michael LaPrade, all you really have left is Ronald Blanchard. And this is why I talked about this being a great for a 22-minute show, but not an hour long because now what, right? But for our story, it's just fine. So Ronald Blanchard at this point will need to be saved by the crime lab results because everything's pointing his way. But a new scenario does quickly emerge. Because Debbie was such a well-known voice in the area, she was a local celebrity of sorts. And as we discussed, her style of broadcasting was a mix of like upbeat energy, but also this kind of girl next door, very personal type of vibe. So she would open up often about her own life, divulge things to her listeners that most DJs wouldn't. So the thought became maybe this was some obsessed, deranged, like play Misty for me kind of listener who stalked Debbie and then did the unthinkable.
I mean, that for sure happens. How many celebrities like have been murdered by an obsessed stalker? Especially when someone talks about their personal life, fans think they genuinely know the person.
Well, I will tell you that Bill Campbell and Debbie, because they'd been in radio together for so long, they would often like talk after they got home from work about some of the wacky calls they'd receive. And while no one in particular stuck out as like a particularly weird listener or caller, it was something that they both had to deal with as DJs. So this was an avenue the police kept in mind. However, it meant the suspect pool stretched as far as their radio signal did, making it incredibly challenging. So the next day, an autopsy is performed on Debbie's body. And remember, based on how she was found, investigators suspected a sexual motive. There is not a single trace of semen or any trauma to Debbie's genitals. And I'm wondering, does that change your opinion, Melissa, about what might have motivated this crime?
I mean, honestly, sometimes there's not a reason, though. Like, I feel like I've stopped trying to figure out why people have done this or like what motivated them. I think that a lot of times there isn't a reason or people can't tell you why they did it because they don't know.
So regarding Debbie's autopsy, the cause of death was especially strange to me. It was listed as mechanical strangulation and near drowning following blows to the head, back of neck, and trunk. And I kind of told you that it was this like small stream or puddle of water flowing in the ditch where Debbie was found. So mm-hmm. the thought was that it was a combination of things, the blows with the hoe, strangling with what I believe was the hoe, which is what caused it to crack. I feel like he came up behind her, whoever it was.
And
that's what I think happened. And then Debbie ended up dying in this small puddle of water. It's just very sad, but it's nothing that anyone should ever have to go through. Given Debbie's notoriety in the community, it was obvious that this area was hit hard by Debbie's death, and people were concerned that there was someone lurking out there. They stopped going to the gardens for a while, and everybody was just basically looking over their shoulder. But in detectives' minds, there was still only one person that could have committed this murder, Ronald Blanchard. And it's a theory that gains traction when 2 days later, the results come back from the crime lab. And you're going to, these are interesting. You're going to be kind of blown away by these. So let's start with the BB gun. Not only was the stock damaged in the back, the barrel was completely bent and just caked with mud inside and around it. And the bolt action, do you know what a bolt action is? It's like when you load it and you go, it's like a barrel on the side, like a little...
I know nothing about guns.
Okay. Well, if you saw it, you'd know it. It's basically a little handle that you load the gun and it loads it into the chamber.
So, oh, like where you pull it down and kind of thing?
That's a shotgun, but a bolt is, I'll show you a picture. I'll put one up. But that basically, it had been deactivated, meaning it had been crushed and basically broken off. It was snapped off completely. And in that bolt area, there were two hairs. And these hairs were tested microscopically to Debbie's. And I had mentioned that earlier in the show that it did match. So not only was it a match, analyst Dave Pompazzini could tell that they were forcibly removed when he looked at them under a microscope, meaning the root came out and everything.
So meaning like they were yanked out when the gun was used to beat Debbie and they just got caught in the bolt.
It's like someone was swinging it like a bat. Almost if you held it by the muzzle and used it as a weapon, you flip it around. And so... it's obviously not good news for Ronald, who was somebody who claimed he simply rolled Debbie over to check her pulse.
Yeah.
And this will probably come as no surprise, but the hairs found on the muddy blade end of the hoe also matched Debbie. So it does confirm that both the BB gun and the hoe were used to beat Debbie to death. And the fact that Ronald confirmed it was his gun.
And the fact that he found the body and the fact that Rhodey was like, this guy did it.
Yep. And there's a lot that Ronald needs to be worried about.
Does he have priors? Are you going to tell us? Like,
did not have any priors. No, he was actually like a family man. He was living in a church with his wife and 6-month-old son and mother-in-law. So I don't know. Maybe at the end of the story, you can kind of make your own, was he even guilty deduction? I don't know. So some of the other things that analysts looked at were Ronald's clothes, which remember he had turned over that day. And technicians did confirm that the blood found on him was Debbie's. Again, no surprise because he admitted touching her. But there were some stains on his clothing that didn't seem to like jibe with his story. There were these faint contact transfers, which is they're basically smudges, right? That totally could have happened. That aligns with Ronald's story that maybe he got a smudge on him as he flipped her over. But there's also these very small circular stains that gave analysts pause. And they're often called impact spatter. And they basically show that they'd been transferred there by a weapon that had been used in an attack.
Okay.
So the lab ships this clothing off to Norm Tiller, who is a world-renowned blood spatter expert in Richmond, Virginia. And Norm is a wonderful, wonderful man. He was always, every time we had reached out with a show that he had been involved in, that he was an analyst on and wanted to do an episode, he was all about it. He agreed to do some super cool reenactments of his work because we would do those too. And he did that for this particular Forensic Files episode as well. And it's a shame because I read that Norm had passed away in 2018. So I was bummed to hear that. He was a good dude. He describes impact splatter as where you would have an existing area of blood and some force is applied to that area, which breaks the blood up into very small droplets and forces it through space until it hits a target.
So like if you have a cup of water and you throw something in it, it's going to splash out and splatter everywhere. Is that like what we're talking about?
The shape and where those splashes are will tell you a lot about what actually hit that water.
Right. And what angle it hit it and... Okay, I get it.
Right. So basically, Norm, the first thing he does is study up on the case materials to kind of get a feel for what statements were given, what the murder weapon in question was, He's trying to recreate the situation he knows. So this is what he knows about the case. He goes, I believe what happened was there were repeated blows to the head by the garden hoe. I believe that was the weapon. There may have been another object used at some point, but I believe that the bloodstains we saw were produced by hitting the head with a garden hoe repeatedly. Oh. So he's pretty convinced based on what he was looking at. And let's be clear, these droplets were not all over the shirt. Like if you're picturing like a, you know how you bleach t-shirts with, you take a paintbrush and you like spatter some bleach on to give it a cool look.
Yeah.
These were like barely visible to the naked eye, but experts can see that stuff. Right. So what Norm does is he's now trying to recreate that attack and see if he can get the same results that are being shown on the perpetrator. So he's trying to replicate the bloodstains on the shirt with this little test about how he thinks the crime went down. So he goes out into the grassy area in the backyard of his lab. He puts on this like white Tyvek suit, puts on a white t-shirt because that's what Ronald was just wearing, a t-shirt. I wanted to see how this blood would react. And he grabs a sponge and he soaks it in blood. And we do our recreation. We use prop blood. And yeah, he duct taped
it.
I know. Well, he duct taped it to a football helmet, set it on the ground, and he puts on his lower mask like he's it's one of those just clear face shields.
Like a COVID shield? Yeah.
Like a COVID shield. And he starts beating the shit out of this football helmet with a sponge on it with a hoe. He takes a hoe and uses the blade in and starts bashing it, right? And blood is flying all over him. He's whacking this thing as hard as he can. And wouldn't you know it, his white t-shirt is covered in these tiny circular impact stains. And yeah, Tiller said, quote, there is only one thing that will cause stains of this sort, and that's forcible impact to existing blood, end quote.
Yeah, I mean, Ronald can sit there and talk about transfer all day long, and he can talk about, you know, rolling her over and trying to feel her pulse and, you know, that he fell down in the ditch. But the blood should not have been in motion at that point, which means it couldn't get up to his shirt.
Well, needless to say, immediately following Tiller's report, Ronald Blanchard was arrested and charged with Debbie Dykus's murder. He maintained his innocence, but he was held on a $100,000 bond. And honestly, the community was kind of shocked, especially the congregation at the Beacon Baptist Church, where Ronald and his family, like, they were members there as well. That's also where they lived. They were so convinced that Ronald would never do something like this that they set up a fund, like a prehistoric GoFundMe to help him fight the case in court. And they actually had a 3-day garage sale to raise money supporting Ronald's innocence. And Pastor Vincent T. Jones told the Roanoke Times in June of 1987, quote, this man is innocent. I know he's not capable of committing a crime like this. The police mean well, but they're jumping to conclusions. He's a Christian. He's not capable of doing anything like this, end quote.
So just because you're a Christian doesn't mean you're a good human. How many cases do we, well, first of all, Catholic priests, let's just leave it at that. But yeah, then what about BTK, who was like a bigwig in the Lutheran church? He was like the treasurer or something. And John List, he was Mr. I Love Jesus. And then he killed his whole family. Like,
yeah,
that means nothing.
Believe whatever gets you through. But some of the worst people I know are hardcore Christians. So.
Well, and like, I think it was Ed Gein's mother was like wildly religious and made him into what he was, you know?
Right. I know. Well, if you ask the congregation, it does. And they fully backed Ronald Blanchard's innocence. So the trial begins in April of 1988. And prosecutors know it's mostly a circumstantial case because they do have a few pieces of evidence linking Blanchard to the gun that presumably played a part in an attack, but it wasn't necessarily the murder weapon. Like, they determined that was the hoe for show, which the prosecution argued was linked to Blanchard by the fact that Rhodey, the crime sniffing canine, went right over to him the day of the crime scene. So they're like, yeah, it's not directly linked, but it kind of is. And get this, there was a witness who testified that she was in that small group of people that had gathered at the crime scene. And while Rhodey was sniffing the hoe initially, she overheard Ronald Blanchard mutter, like, that dog is coming straight to me.
Ooh.
So Melissa, I ask you, so was he saying that because he knew he was guilty? Or was Blanchard saying that because he knew he'd touched the body and assumed like this trained dog would come his way, since technically that's a direct connection?
He said it because he's guilty AF.
I agree.
No doubt in my mind, guilty.
Well, it's definitely a question that the jury was tasked with answering. There were actually other witnesses that testified that Blanchard was acting pretty squirrely as Rhodey was like sniffing around. And Glenelle Fullman, when she was asked on the stand, she gave a really interesting answer. So in regards to a suspect's demeanor, she said their adrenaline goes crazy, like the fear factor comes out and they don't want to be caught. They want to make sure they didn't do anything wrong. Gets them all excited and puts more scent out from the body, which means better tracking. So basically, Glenelle is saying dogs can smell fear.
That's interesting because they do say that like stress sweat smells different than just like regular sweat. And I don't know that I would necessarily say fear. Like I wholeheartedly believe that dogs instinctively know when a person is bad. Like I've seen my puggle Lucy, someone who I can't stand, and the first time Lucy met her, like all the hairs on the back on her back stood up, and she's never done that to anyone. Like I just feel like dogs know who's a good human and who's not.
I agree. And if Glenelle Fullman says they can smell fear, I'm gonna trust a trained dog handler. Someone with an overdrawn PetSmart account.
I don't even want to talk about it. I gotta go there when we're done recording.
Well, all of that aside, the biggest blow to Ronald Blanchard's defense was that expert testimony from Norm Tiller. He testified about his findings and reiterated that the only way those circular impact splatters could get onto Ronald's shirt was from forcible impact, like hitting Debbie Dykus on the head with a hoe, not simply rolling her over to check for a pulse. So from the defense's standpoint, all they could really lean on was the idea that you got the wrong guy. Ronald Blanchard didn't do it, and police only honed in on him because he was the most convenient suspect. They did it right away, which didn't give them time to investigate anybody else, which we know does happen. But then Blanchard decides to take the stand.
and we know how well this works out. Why are people so stupid?
He didn't waver a single bit from what he told police back in 1987. So except for one little tiny sentence that might have doomed him, in my opinion, he was asked three questions. Number one, did you murder Debbie Dykus? To which Blanchard replied, no, I did not. So the defense asked again, question number two, are you sure you didn't murder Debbie Dykus? And Blanchard responds, I am positive. And then pesky little question number three, do you remember everything that happened that night? And Blanchard responds by saying, no, I do not. And those four little words added enough reasonable doubt on top of all the other circumstantial evidence in this case for the jury to be like, maybe he did kill her and was just in shock if he doesn't remember it.
Yeah, this guy's not very bright, huh? Like, no, I didn't do it, but I don't actually remember.
I know. I feel like they could have stopped at question two and he might have been okay. But so the one thing we haven't talked about really is the motive. Why would this guy who was out on a walk, something he does every single night, just murder a woman gardening in cold blood for no apparent reason? And there are a few theories in play here, as well as kind of one of my own. So theory number one, Debbie's boyfriend, Bill Campbell, told us when we did the forensic files about an incident not long before the murder. And here was his exact soundbite. I remember one day we came home and there was a bird that had come down the chimney and we were actually able to retrieve this bird. It was at the bottom of the fireplace and Debbie called a vet. And she asked what we could do to like nurture this baby bird back to health or keep it alive. So the thought was that Debbie saw Ronald Blanchard hunting birds with his BB gun and spoke up, called him out on it. And he snapped back and then an argument ensued and Blanchard just beat Debbie to death.
That's legitimate. Like she could have said something that pissed him off and it just escalated.
Absolutely. Well, theory number two is that this was a straight sexual assault that got out of hand and it left Blanchard no choice but to then kill Debbie right then and there. And based on the way her clothes were found, it's possible.
Yeah.
Or theory number three, which is mine, kind of a combo platter of one and two. But I think that Debbie confronted Blanchard about shooting birds. She was this earthly country girl, right? She loved nature. Mm-hmm. She loved everything about living things, plants, animals, people, whatever. So he calls him out on this. He gets enraged and because this obviously happened at Debbie's car, not down in the garden. So as she's putting her tools away, I think that Blanchard came up behind her and basically full on attacked her. And because there was no evidence of sexual assault, I believe that Blanchard then staged the crime scene to make people think it was some kind of like sick rapist terrorizing women, and then reported the crime to deflect suspicion away from himself. So I think he staged the sexual assault.
I don't know. I don't get a good vibe from him. Like, I just have the fact that Rhodey went right up to him is really like getting to me. Like I said, I genuinely believe dogs can tell.
Unless he had cookies in his pocket.
Well, maybe he had pepperonis. I often have them in my pocket as well. But I don't know. I feel like he did try to rape her, and she like fought him so hard that he ended up killing her. Like, it got out of hand and he killed her.
Well, whatever the case, the jury deliberated for just 3 hours before finding Ronald Blanchard guilty of first degree murder, abduction, attempted sexual assault, and possession of a firearm. And he was double LY, sentenced to 2 life terms. And as of this recording, May of 2025, he's now 58 years old and still incarcerated at Beaumont Correctional Facility in Virginia. So get this. This is pretty cool. So on Forensic Files, we would always reach out to the perpetrator via letter to ask if they want to interview for the show, or at the very least provide, I guess, some insight on the investigation, their feelings. And I obviously wrote Ronald a letter, and here it is. I printed out a copy. I'm hiding the letterhead. So super simple, maybe 5-6 sentences, just explaining what we're looking for. And we mail it off. And months later, Ronald responds. And I was kind of blown away because we didn't get many responses. So I open up his letter, and it's Ronald basically denying my request for an interview, but at the same time beating around the bush that he might have had something to do with Debbie's death. And it wasn't a full-on confession like I'd hoped for, but it was like, I don't know, he seemed remorseful because some of the highlights of the letter were, "I deeply regret the pain and suffering that I've caused so many people, and never doubt that I don't realize what I've done and accept the consequences of my actions." So anyway, that's pretty cool.
I don't think the fact that he doesn't have a reason or never gave one, like, I don't think that's weird. I think we see that a lot. And I think sometimes there is no reason. I mean, maybe he just thought he could get away with it. He was in this rural area, figured there was no one around.
Yeah, I don't know. But if he was indeed religious, maybe he, a lot of prisoners will find God again in prison. So maybe it was part of some healing or some therapy to like take accountability. Even if it wasn't a direct admission for his crime, it was something maybe to get it, feel a little better about himself at that point.
Right.
But that is the insanely sad and completely senseless murder of 31-year-old disc jockey Debbie Dykus. And I don't have much in the way of updates on anybody else, except that I did read Debbie's boyfriend, Bill Campbell, got married to a woman named Ellen Marie Peterson in 2019. And they actually got married at the 2WD radio station. So that told me that Bill still worked there after all of those years. Maybe she was another station employee, because why else have it at the station unless it was like two colleagues at the, you know?
Right.
So, I don't know, but that's what I know.
Oh, good for him.
Yeah. He's a really good guy. Like, everybody that we interviewed for this one was just top notch. Seriously.
Well, I'm designating Rhodey as this week's MU MVP.
Way to go, Rhodey.
Whoop, whoop.
He died in 1998.
Okay, well, way to just ruin my life.
I'm just saying. He did his service. Thank you, Rhodey.
Oh, the goodest boy.
Yeah. Anyway, let us know what you think, you guys. I guarantee that one is going to be a tougher story to find out there because, again, it's so short. Like, there's not a lot of mystery to it, so I doubt it's going to be covered by a lot of people. So here's an obscure one for you.
Well, that was a good one, and thank you for telling it. And I know that I personally love when it's a case that you worked on. I feel like there's like more of a connection. Like, I thought it was really cool where you had kind of worked on the Corey Parker episode I covered two weeks ago.
Yeah. You know what? It turns out after we did the episode, I was like, oh, I started really looking at pictures of everything. I'm like, oh, I found all this stuff that I shot. And you know what's cool for this one? I shot these table. I was shooting tabletops, they're called. for all these episodes. And I'm looking through the old forensic files of this case. And I'm like, oh, I shot that. Tabletops were basically pictures of anybody involved in the story that we wanted to illustrate by not just graphically putting a picture up on screen, but yeah, we'd shoot it in an element. So Ronald Blanchard was a waterman or like a fisherman. So I had to go out and buy fishing line and ropes and set up a little scene with his picture to kind of illustrate what he did. It brought the picture to life a little bit. And they were fun to shoot because he had to be super creative.
Forensic Files, that's definitely like a Forensic Files thing. Like I can picture it in my head. And they're usually in some sort of frame. And yeah.
They stole the idea from ESPN, but that's fine. Those are my instructions. Watch ESPN and do that.
Oh my God, I love it.
Anyway.
Well, thank you for telling us that. And yeah, guys, we would love to know what you think. And we would love to know if you can guess our guests for the last week of the block. Sorry.
You have all the clues you need.
Yeah, you can do this. I have so much faith in you.
And these stickers are worth a guess. Even if it's a wrong guess, take a shot. Because these are cool stickers.
Yeah, just take a shot. What's the worst that can happen? Well, if you want to submit your guesses, you can hit us up on our socials. We are on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and Blue Sky at Murder Unscripted.
We are?
Yes, we are. I set us up on Blue Sky. So we're on
there. What's Blue Sky?
It's super cool and hip. You wouldn't understand, Grandpa.
Oh, is it like MySpace?
Yes. The new MySpace. It's kind of Facebook meets Twitter kind of thing, but there's actually no algorithm. So it's more to do with how much you're engaged with other people on the platform, which I kind of like. Like,
I think there's an algorithm. There's always an algorithm, but
supposedly there's not, but I don't know. But anyway, we're on it. You can send us your guesses via email, murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com. Or you can fill out the little form on our website, which is www.murderunscriptedpod.com. Tune in next week. We're going to have a brand new case, which will be the last case of this block. And then we will have our super fun guest. I'm so excited.
Can't wait.
But I think that's all we got for you. So we will see you next week. And until then, be safe, be kind, and remember, perverts don't wear signs that say they're perverts.
They do shoot birds with BB guns and lurk around gardens, though.
I was going to say they might have blood splatter on their shirt.
True. See ya.
Bye.